Welcome to the Arts Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. The audience for the next Chamber Music Society of Little Rock concert is in for a treat, with baritone Misha Bouvier and the song recital he has put together. I'll admit to prejudice, as we don't have enough such. Solo instrumentalists, yes. The Guitar Foundation of America, the Cliburn International Piano Competition, are among those who have brought outstanding young musicians to Arkansas, as does the Concert Artists Guild, often with ensembles. The Marilyn Horn Foundation was formed specifically to keep alive the tradition of the art song recital. And for a number of years, Artspree worked with the foundation, and we heard some great singers. Lawrence Brownlee was one of our first and is now heard regularly in principal roles on the Metropolitan Opera HD telecasts. So thank you, Concert Artists Guild, and welcome Misha Bouvier, whose name sounds part Russian and French.
It's a little deceptive because my real name is actually Michel Bouvier, which is 100% French.
Ah.
Misha is a nickname that my mother gave me. She was quite taken by Mikhail Baryshnikov, his dancing, I believe. So she just really enjoyed his dancing and loved his nickname back in Russia. So she thought she had a little Michel Bouvier on the way. I am the fifth Michel Bouvier in the family, so to give me a nickname. And it's actually ended up being a wonderful name to perform with because there aren't too many Misha Bouviers in the world.
So the background that you have, apart from your names, did you grow up with music?
I grew up with music in the house. I have very early memories of records being played in the house regularly. Lots of jazz, lots of classical, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald. But as far as my participation in music, I was a bit of a late bloomer, even for a singer. I didn't really actively participate in any sort of music until I got to high school. I went to a wonderful private school. I was very lucky, very fortunate. And this private school was not very large. There were maybe 350 of us in grades 8 through 12. But we had over half of the school in the choir. So it was a very strong music program. And I sort of got bitten by that bug.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably always there. I just didn't know how to sort of express it. I would listen to a lot of music, but I never sang. And I was just very fortunate. It was the right place at the right time, I think. There weren't many people in the school that sang, although half of the school was in the choir. So I got all of the roles in the musicals and, you know, really was able to excel in a very supportive, comfortable way.
So the quality of your voice, it was a surprise as how much more of a bass baritone you were?
I don't fully remember singing or what my voice would have sounded like. I do remember when I started singing in choir that I had an unusually low voice, although I was not a bass. It just was a voice that went down very low, and it did have sort of a dark timbre to it. And luckily, like I had said earlier, it was a wonderful music program with a wonderful musical director of the choirs. And he heard something that I, of course, had no idea was even there in my voice. And he sort of nurtured it. I know the voice that I have now. And it's obviously developed over the years a bit. But surprisingly, as early as I can remember, eighth or ninth grade, this was pretty much the instrument that I had.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, like many, that the lower voices take longer to develop. So I do think that I've developed probably as much as I'm going to develop. The range is pretty solidified. The color has been consistent. But I'm not young at this point, and so I think I will have some longevity, just as you said, that might carry me. I hope carries me, well into my older age.
Well, I think the 20s probably saw the voice gradually getting to its level. So that by your mid-30s, you can be very confident that you won't suddenly develop a high soprano squeak or something like that.
Yes. Yes. But it certainly feels a lot better now that I've made it into my 30s in terms of the function of the voice and the consistency and just, waking up every day and knowing that it's there and it's going to be what it was yesterday.
Did you go to a conservatory, a music school?
I did sort of. I have a bachelor's from Boston University School for the Arts and a master's from the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music.
But I noticed that opera doesn't seem to be in your repertoire that I've read so far.
It's not as prominently in my repertoire, which is something that I think about often that I'd like to change. The work that I'm getting now is more of a concert and recital variety. Mm-hmm. But I have done some opera in the past, and it's something that I enjoy doing very much.
I have to go down to the program with you because I think it's fascinating.
Okay. Yes.
Paul Bowles, I have to think, I don't know, he must be American from the title of the songs that you're singing.
He is American, and he is better known as a writer of fiction and short story in this country, I think, than as a composer. But he was a composer in his own right, and a fabulous composer, in my opinion. These particular songs are absolutely beautiful settings of Tennessee Williams poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And there's four, and they're just wonderful. It very much speaks to the time period when he was writing them, but there's jazzy and bluesy bits in three of the four songs, and then the fourth is just wonderfully sort of slow and folky and American, if that's fair, you know.
Yes.
Just lovely songs. Together as a set for a baritone, they make a lovely start to a program or set of songs in less than 10 minutes.
They sit well in the voice, so you don't go into it feeling a little tense. You
yes.
have to have something you feel comfortable with when you open and you're the only person on stage except the pianist.
You know, I don't want to expose too many of my tricks, but of course you're absolutely right. It's important to warm up in the space.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I agree.
The next one is a group of arranged Benjamin Britten. They're folk songs. The Sally Gardens, I Married Me a Wife, and the Foggy Foggy Dew, and Whaley Whaley, they're all wonderful folk songs that Benjamin Britten arranged. I love the folk songs, and Benjamin Britten has a marvelous way of twisting his accompaniments. But Charles Ives is not easy.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, there is some very difficult Charles Ives. For instance, we will be performing Tom Sails Away. I've been putting that piece together with various pianists for years now. It's a very tricky piece to time. It's a very tricky piece to coordinate. So I totally agree. But then something like Memories, which has two parts, very pleasant at the Opera House and then the rather sad, which is a sort of a recollection of an old tune, couldn't be more sing-songy. Just sort of goes along. So he has a wonderful variety. And I've been singing Charles Ives since I was in my undergraduate years. And I love the composer. I love his songs. I think he's maybe a little bit underheard, which is a shame, but he also carries with him a little bit of a stigma. I think there is an opinion associated with his music that it can be difficult or it can be jarring or very non-tonal. And there's actually a lot of wonderful folksy song repertoire in his output.
Mm-hmm. But he belongs to that group of composers who all were faced with a public who couldn't understand what they were doing. Now, in the 21st century, some of those composers' works are totally acceptable. They don't sound dissonant because we've all got so used to settings and harmonies, dissonances that fit the mood, and he was just probably as much ahead of his time as some of the others.
Yes, it's a remarkable story with him. I'm at a loss for the particular music historians who said that he was probably the most widely recognized or the first widely recognized American composer in Europe, which I think says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And but then this is the same man that had to publish his own book of 114 songs, and I think the story goes that he sent it to several libraries and some actually sent it back. So it's remarkable to me that he was misunderstood or ignored or whatever when he was composing. But you're right, it makes complete sense. It is the development of the sort of the musical style.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's always ever happened that way. There's things that are wildly popular when they first are premiered, but there's also things that are wildly disruptive when they're first premiered or completely overlooked. But he's a fascinating composer to me.
Well, that's great. And then there's an intermission. And then you start with Michael Flanders. Flanders and Swan.
Yeah.
And you haven't got the hippopotamus. Are you saving that for an encore, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, I thought it's such a favorite that I thought not to do it. You know, I mean, they're all favorites. That's the problem, is that you probably know well the four that are on the program, but I tried to steer away from the absolute favorites.
No, the only one I'm really familiar with is Madeira, Madeira.
Oh, that's a wonderful piece.
I've got two LPs I'm looking at right now. One of it is called The Bestiary of Flanders and Swan, Songs and Verses About Animals. And it does everything from the seahorse to the elephant to the spider, et cetera, et cetera. And then the one that really started their career at the Edinburgh Festival, I think it was, At the Drop of a Hat. And that's one that, by the time they'd been on air and on programs for a year, everybody knew the words.
Yes, it's remarkable. I spent sort of, you know, a second childhood at my grandparents' farm that was very close by. And my grandfather, Midwestern man, loved operetta, and he loved things like Victor Borga. And so, you know, you had asked me earlier about my musical upbringing. I mean, that was part of it. I was very young. This was probably preteen, and we would watch Victor Borga routines. And I love that sort of satire and comedy, but at the same time, complete musical chops, you know, just absolutely excellent players and singers and so on and so forth. So I really enjoy this British comic duo. I think they have some wonderful songs.
Yeah. And as you so rightly say, when you hear that kind of music and realize, as you get older anyway, these are complete musicians. They know exactly what they're doing. And they could do a classical turn without any trouble at all with the best musicians around. And suddenly they're making a statement that appeals to so many more people.
Completely envious. I'm completely envious of people that can do that. I love it.
And then you end with William Balcombe, who is another outstanding musician, humorist. These songs, the cabaret songs, he has been here with his wife doing these sort of programs. Are they all from a certain period or from different parts as he sort of found his way into jazz? And he was very influential with Tremonisha, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And these songs span, I may be wrong, but I think 1963 to 1996.
Gosh, that is a wide range.
Yeah, that's the dates that are popping in my head. But, I mean, it's really a wide range. And he had four volumes, eventually, of these. They've come in segments. And you're absolutely right to say that there is a variety of sort of musical style within the four volumes that I think Hal Leonard is now reproduced as a one single volume of all the complete cabaret songs. But that's several decades of composition, and they're fabulous. Tons of variety within the four volumes.
Well, there's tons of variety in this program, Misha. I think that it's going to be something your audience will be delighted with.
Well, I certainly hope so, because that is exactly what I was after when I was crafting this recital. Yes, all the songs are in English, but I think that's totally fine, and there's still a lot of variety.
That was baritone Misha Bouvier, who will be in Little Rock February the 5th, presented by the Chamber Music Society of Little Rock, 7:30 in the Parish Hall at St. Mark's Episcopal Church, Evergreen and Mississippi. For tickets, call 501-626-6064 or online chambermusiclr.com.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Arkansas. At the Arkansas Rep, it's the final week for The Whipping Man. Shows at 7 p.m. Wednesday and Thursday, 8 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, and final shows Sunday at 2 and 7 p.m. Also wrapping up this week at the Arkansas Art Center's Children's Theater, Rumpelstiltskin, Shows Friday at 7 and Saturday and Sunday at 2. The UCA Public Appearances Series presents a lecture by Jessica Fellows, author of The World of Downton Abbey and niece of the show's creator, Julian Fellows. Thursday, 7:30 p.m. at Reynolds Performance Hall in Conway. On display around town at the Arkansas Art Center, Color, An Artist's Tale. And opening Tuesday, How to Kill, World War II Watercolors by Robert Andrew Parker. At the UALR Galleries, The Penland Experience, works from the UALR Permanent Art Collection and the collection of Robin and John Horn. And at Historic Arkansas Museum, Capturing Early Arkansas in Depth, the Stereo View Collection of Alan Gates. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
Theater Squared, the Northwest Arkansas repertory based in Fayetteville, has been on edge with anticipation for the opening of Look Away, an original play by Bob Ford, the artistic director of the company. He and executive director Martin Miller join me to talk about the play, which has had several trial runs in new play festivals in Arkansas and elsewhere, and been very well received. And Bob felt it was finally ready to be part of the main stage season. So my two guests bring us up to date. Bob has a lot going for him and touches on some of the reasons he feels its time has come.
It looked like it would complement the season very well. We decided to put it in. It's been kind of around for a few years.
Yeah, I guess what's so exciting about it is it's not only, and this is Martin, by the way, it's not only an Arkansas story in its basis on an oral history, it was also very much created here. I mean, created at the Arkansas New Play Festival, in readings in Fayetteville and in Little Rock, and it came so far over the course of those readings and the many, many comments that we got and that Bob got from just audience members and fellow artists that this season we just, this is a play we need to do right now. This is really exciting. It's where it needs to be. It's going to be a world premiere. We couldn't feel more excited about it.
The other Arkansas connection is that it's based on research by Jeannie Wayne, who's in the history department here at the U of A. She's one of the deans of that department, has done in-depth research on the Wilson Company and the Wilson family in northeastern Arkansas. So it's a real Arkansas story, really put together by Arkansans, Arkansas artists.
Did you find, now that you've come into its final shape to have it as a world premiere, that it has changed dramatically in terms of the way the story has been put together?
That's a great question. I recently went back to the oral history taken by Jeannie Wayne from William Tony, whose nickname is Snake, which is a fantastic nickname. And I read it through, and I was really surprised at how much of the story came out of that oral history. I've taken a lot of poetic license. Fascinating to me how what playwrights and novelists need to do to get to some truth that they perceived in the real story, to turn that into a truth that can be received dramatically by an audience. For example, there's some fantastic real-life characters in that Wilson family, and I asked Jeannie, in the particular night that this happened in 1933, event the play is based on, I asked Jeannie if, you know, is it possible that these three individuals might have been in the house, even though two of them were living elsewhere at the time? She said, yeah, sure, it's possible. They might have all been there. In order to make this work dramatically, I really wanted to include these other Wilson family members. But we don't know whether they were there. You know, it's possible that they weren't there. That is an example of the kind of poetic license. And then obviously all of the dialogue, although, again, there's actually a couple of lines in the play taken directly from the memory of Snake Tony, from his memory of what happened. And it's really rooted in the real story. Again, in order to get to some kind of universal truth, maybe, the kind of truth that you get when you turn something into a story, I've had to bend things a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want anyone to think that I am depicting these the Wilson family members as they really were. I think we all know when we go to the theater or watch a movie, well, obviously this is through the eyes of the writer. On the other hand, I think their character traits are taken very much from accounts of who they were at that time. And their personalities.
Going right back to the beginning, you got the idea, or did the historian approach you with this to make it into a play?
Jeannie and I were in a reading. She had a book coming out. We both had books coming out, and I had never met her, and we were at a reading one evening, and I think we may have just gotten this grant from the Department of Arkansas Heritage to create four new Arkansas plays, and I was fascinated by the research that she had done that kind of emerged when we talked about her reading, and I took her aside and I said, tell me stories. I'm looking for a story. Mm-hmm. And that's how it emerged. She told me three or four stories, and this is the one that really hooked me. The high drama and the way that this story, which is about these two African-American guys who caught with a couple of white girls and assumptions are made and a mob forms. Both the drama of that and also what it reminds us of about our past just hooked me in. Mm-hmm. And when there are other things that happened later in the story that according to Snake Tony actually happened that really sunk the talons in even deeper for me. But I can't say what they are. I can't tell that because I'll be
with some of your other plays, that there is something extra that's the one sure hook for you.
Yes. In this case, I didn't have to make it up. It was handed to me, particularly ironic moment towards the very end of this story that grabbed me.
Mm-hmm. Why the title, Bob?
You know, obviously, there's a wonderful double meaning with Look Away. One, the first, it is the refrain from the great Southern anthem, and it carries with it a certain, depending on where you're from, it could be a pejorative, but it's really identified with the South, kind of a hymn of the South. Very thematic, and for me is the meaning of we are all looking away from something that maybe we should not be looking away from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my perspective. Another person's perspective might be, tell me another. You know, this is a reality that I grew up with, and I'm nothing surprising here. Hopefully, you know, thank you for telling this story.
But okay.
You know, everyone's going to receive it differently. I think what we were discovering in the rehearsal process with the actors and this fantastic director from Boston, Benny Sato Ambush, is that it's, as with any story, you hope, universal. People struggling to love against all odds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think we can all relate to that.
Which in the end, of course, you know, when you look at these really relatable characters, and this is just my perspective as an audience member, you know, you see they're making tough choices with the resources they have, with the information they have, and in the context that they live in. And it's not a, you know, Bob talks about coming in with the perspective of a Northerner. Well, he's also a Northerner who's been here for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And there's a tendency, you know, if this story was being written from outside of Arkansas, I have no doubt that there would be a tendency to write some very flat characters, a depiction of what people imagine the South is about or something like that. But actually, no, these are very real, dimensional people. You know, in many ways, tackling things admirably, in other ways, so freighted with the time they lived in, and it's just fascinating. And, you know, as somebody who grew up here, and it's where we're from, but it's nice to have the sprinklings of hope that you find in the play, and also that you find in the course that history has taken since the play, is another reason, I think, to really feel good about experiencing this show.
Have in the previous runouts or connections with the play in the new play festivals and the sort of experimental writing area, have you had mixed audiences and seen and heard the reactions from both sides?
Yeah, we have. And the conversation has been just absolutely exciting. And I feel, you know, we're talking about history and of race relations and power relationships, you know, that still go on. And it feels important. It feels relevant. And it's tremendous. Yeah, the first reading we had a pretty good number from the African-American community. And it was great. The conversation that came out of it was great. It's really a provocative story. Further that conversation.
Now, for you, Bob, this gestation of a new work, is this for you ideal, or does it make it more difficult each time you realize that the audience is not responding or there are questions coming up from the audience that are giving you a slightly new perspective?
It's really ideal. It's I so value audience response. We've got a great community here of folks who love new work, and so they come, and then people come who have not seen this process, and getting that kind of unvarnished, untarnished perspective is really valuable to me. It doesn't mean that I run home and go and change everything based on what they hear, but I can really get a sense of, well, you know what? I thought that was clear. It's not clear. I'm going to go back and clarify that. Or, wow, I never thought of that perspective. Mm-hmm. And this play has a lot of that influence in it. And it's not just the audience. It's all the actors who've worked on it over the years. I was counting. I think we've had like at least 20 different actors have worked on this play. They all feed me as well. And the play has gone through not huge changes, but fairly important changes even in the last 3 weeks in rehearsals. I added a new scene at the beginning that was never there before. I'm really anxious to see it before a new audience this weekend.
In the cast now, are there people who were in the first go-round?
It's interesting. One of the role of the woman, the actress playing that, is Rebecca Harrison. When I wrote this play, I actually had her in mind. And she was not able to do the very first reading. So that's not a direct answer to your question. There is Justin Walker, who's playing the young white guy, Bobby Wilson, was in either the first or the second reading. But then we have everybody else is new.
How big a cast is it?
Five. Really talented group too. That we took a lot of time casting this one.
Yeah, we've got a really exciting director attached to it too. I want to mention that.
Is he African American?
He is. Benny Sato Ambush is someone who run between 5 and 10 theater companies as an artistic director over the course of his career. His work, together with Bob's work and this fine cast, all mixed up in one potent world premiere.
From Theatre Squared in Fayetteville, Bob Ford, Artistic Director, and Executive Director Martin Miller. Bob is the author of Look Away, which just opened and is in its world premiere. The play will run through February the 22nd. For tickets, call 479-443-5600 or visit theatre2.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation.